Welcome to the Tibet House U.S. Menma Online Podcast. This podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. Menma membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about our ongoing mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture, please visit our websites at thus.org, menma.org, and bobthurman.com. This extended episode with Deepak Chopra and Robert Thurman was originally recorded 2016 at Tibet House US in New York City. To learn more about our ongoing mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture, please visit our websites at thus.org, menma.org, and bobthurman.com.
Deepak and I have been like doing different things, and it's really wonderful to discover you, Deepak. It really is. So now, anyway, tonight we're gonna mediate or discuss the meeting, the encounter of Buddha and God, whatever that is. They have had some encounters in the past, I believe, actually, as recorded in the various scriptures. From the Buddhist side, I don't know if in the Abrahamic, I don't think they have any account of Jehovah meeting Buddha. He didn't report back on it anyway, at least not to Moses. What I feel in my heart really is like a feeling of tribute to India, to the great Mahabharata, great Mother India, because somehow in the dawn of the world, you know, in the 2,500 years ago or 3,000 years ago, the dawn of this recent era of the world, somehow India is the great place where people really saw most deeply, I think, really. This new American, Euro-American culture, you know, the sort of product of New York, that produced New York, you know, that produced some aspects of ourselves, our conditioning is based in the Mediterranean. You know, thinks of itself as coming from the Mediterranean. But actually, the Mediterranean was connected by a toll road, like the superhighway of that time, that was maintained by the Achaemenids, the Persians, which went right to the Indus River. And everybody, every conqueror worth their salt in the Mediterranean world, wanted nothing better but to go to India and conquer something. They didn't know what, but they knew they wanted to get there because they knew that people in India were having more fun. And they wanted, of course, to go and grab that themselves. You know, they were there with their olives and ricina, and they were dreaming of 2,500 varieties of mango. Now, interestingly, that land of such a great wealth, you know, by far the greatest alluvia of Eurasia, you know, the Harappan civilization, Mohenjo-daro, you know, the Indus, the five rivers of the Indus, was at its height 15 times larger than ancient Egypt. You know, a larger alluvium with more people and more wealth and more produce and so on. And therefore, it is in such a country that, such a land, you know, that people first came to both Veda and then Vedanta. You know, Vedanta meaning, you know, the Veda meaning knowledge, Vedanta meaning, in a way, the end of knowledge, you know, the final conclusion of knowledge. It occurs to me, too, you know, that somehow one of the great Vedantists really was Buddha, in the sense that the Vedantic revolution, you could say, in the middle of first millennium before the Common Era, or starting really at the beginning of first millennium before the Common Era, but ending in the middle, was the time when people threw off the, you know, first level of God. You know, the God, the protector, the tribal God, God the one who is somehow connected with your fight for survival. Because in India at that time, survival became relatively easy. Things were relatively well organized. You know, life was more gentle, really, actually, in that place. And so people kind of threw off that, and they decided that the human being need not fear reality. And they decided that the human being was capable of knowing reality. This was the great insight. You realize, Deepak, in 10 minutes you brilliantly conveyed the essence of Vedanta. And in the very first thing that you said was everything was contained too, which is that the only reason that we suffer is that we do not know what our own reality is. And that do not knowing is in a Buddha put it, sometimes he put it to force just like that. There was no difference. I think there is, first thing I want to definitively announce, there is no difference between Buddha, Dharma, and Vedanta. Absolutely no difference. Some semantic confusion people attach to, but really there is no difference. And in this, because this is the crux and the essence of it, is that this not knowing is not merely just like, you know, like I don't know, like I don't know what is in that pipe. I do not know what is behind that wall. That sort of not knowing doesn't really hurt me. The kind of not knowing is that I think I do know what I am. I think I do know what you are. I'm Bob. You are Deepak. And Bob is not Deepak. And somehow Bob is not you. And Bob is like, therefore worrying, because there's so much more of you than there is Bob. And so if I think you and Bob are different, then it's like, well, who's going to get whom? Who is saved from whom? Then I think maybe God is not me. I think maybe the pillar is not me, the floor, the objects. I misknow myself as a separate self. I misknow the other as a separate other. I'm put in the situation, therefore, put myself through this misknowing in the situation of struggling with the universe. You struggle with the universe. Who is you think is going to win? You know you're going to lose, of course. I mean, now and then you're feeling kind of a little bit excited or happy, or you're wearing like a Donna Karan suit. Maybe you think you'll win. You know, you feel so good. But underneath, you know you'll lose. You know? And therefore, that you can either be a little giddy about how it's fine, but in the long run, you know you're going to lose. Whereas, if you know your nature, you know that we are the same. We are one. Reality is one. You and the universe, you are the universe. How can you lose? There's no opponent, you see. And this is the wonderful thing about India. Comes from India. The idea that we can know our way free of suffering. Now, you could call it jnana yoga, you can call it bhakti yoga, this and that, but it isn't just intellectual. Because this kind of jnana is not mere intellectual. It is, of course, not intellectual. Because, you know, knowing the nature of reality needs the intellect at least to get focused. But then through Raja Yoga method, through meditative thing, through Karma Yoga, through acting in a way that you are acting in tuned with everything. And finally through love, because once you know you are everything, then your sort of way of experiencing energy-wise being everything is the same thing as love. You know? Why do we like being in love? Because, remember, when we're not in love, we're all alone against the universe. And it's outdoing us all the time. Suddenly, we feel one with another being, usually as all we can manage. And it's usually also temporary. Because we for that moment where we're really happy in love is where we're only living for the happiness of the other being. We lose ourselves in the beloved, right? We die in the beloved. We do. And then at a certain point, we feel, that's enough of that. How much are they losing themselves in me? And then immediately the separation is reaffirmed. And then it's like, who is more with who? And then it's endless dissatisfaction. But that moment, that expansion of the identity to be two, or two as one. Imagine, therefore, in light, the state of enlightenment, our actual reality, our actual birthright as human beings. As aware, reflective beings, which is that we have the ability, the right, and the natural tendency to be in love with all beings, the entire universe, all of the time. God means God the lover, you know, God means being in love with everything. And love especially also means, remember, love, you know, bhakti doesn't mean just wishing to possess the beloved. Love means willing the happiness of the beloved. So it's like the endless expansion into happiness. So I have to hail India, the Plato, Socrates, was into it. He saw the harmony of the soul, and he saw something, the getting out of the cave, but he was there with all those tyrants, you know? And they were, all they had was olives and goat, a little bit of goat burger and some Ritzina, a few fish, you know, a little bit, no big alluvium, you know? No Greek could manage. They had to go and conquer Egypt to get some wheat, you know? Because you can't grow that much in these non-alluvial countries, you know, seafaring countries. And so it's really, we have to thank India for this, and this rediscovery of India today. You know, the West Renaissance is just beginning. Its first wave was the discovery of the humanism and naturalism of the Greeks, breaking away from the grip of the church and the grip of sort of a lower idea of God, that God the punisher, God the ruler, God is doing this, that mostly was dominating people, feeling that their minds were unworthy, that they could not understand the nature of reality. And we discovered, well, we can understand nature, but then nature was defined as material nature. The atom, you know, the mathematics, the geometry, the pivot, you know. And so then for 400, 500 years now, we've been discovering nature, you know, and the human nature, and we've been breaking away from that spirit. In fact, we are scared of spirit because we associate spirit with the Inquisition, with some sort of auto da fe, you know, so we were like running away from the spirit. But in fact, and we think our Renaissance is over, and then some people even say, well, that was no good. The rest of the Enlightenment ended, it caused a lot of trouble. And they're even like giving up, you know. But our Renaissance really gets rolling when we rediscover India. So this is where I have to hail to you, Deepak. Because in a way, you are the voice of India. Mm-hmm. And ironically, you are educated as a Westerner. You know, when we did our dialogue at Columbia, remember, it was so funny because you were like, doing science, and I was doing India. I was saying, but wait a minute, Indian science, remember?
Yeah.
It was like really, it was counterpoint, you know. But you see, India gives us the courage that we can understand. Who, isn't that preposterous? Who do you think? If you said today, you went and announced to your employees, to your friends, to your relatives, I understand my nature, I understand the nature of reality. If you had announced that, what do you think they would do? They would offer you a dish of Prozac. Or St. John's wort, I hope. Or maybe just some nice Ayurvedic remedy. Because the religious, you can't do that. Only God knows that on the religious side in the West. So nobody can know everything. And on the scientific side, you know how they do. They get billions of dollars. And they study and study. And then when they run out of the dollars, they proclaim, aha, we learned a great deal, and now we know so much more about how much we don't know. So give us another grant. Because in principle, you cannot know. You cannot understand. And sometimes, of course, they do announce when their grant providers are getting discouraged with them. They occasionally announce that, well, we will be knowing. Another 60 years of calculations will bear us out. We'll have the grand theory, you know, so give us another 60 years to prove it. Whereas in India, from this ancient time, they're saying, you don't need a machine. You don't even need mathematics. I mean, that's an ornament, mathematics. These machines are useful. It's all right. But you don't need that because you are the wondrous machine, long before computers in the cybernetic age. You are the wondrous machine that can turn round in your footsteps, look back into yourself, and fully understand yourself. Completely understand that you are not. There's nothing in you separate from the great self of the universe, as the Vedantic would say, and Buddha would say, you are selfless with regard to that petty self, and your great self of selflessness is at one with all beings, and has all knowledge available to it, knows everything by being one with everything. And when you know that, and that's what I was, you know, I'm always thinking, there's Buddha over there, by the way, standing over there,
and that's
an image, and there's another one sitting. And I'm always happy, when I look at Buddha, I'm thinking, thank goodness he's smiling. Imagine, now I understand everything. And then you, this next minute, you're going, oh no, what a bummer. Right? then we would all be depressed. But instead, they said, well, when you know, then you are happy, you see. It's only by not knowing that you're unhappy. Do you realize the vast difference in those two possible claims? Because if our reality is in fact happiness, if our reality is in fact love, if our reality is in fact wisdom, that means the more we can let go of our false constructions of unreality, the more we kind of collapse, actually, the more happy we become. So we don't have to fight with I'm very happy you announced that we all have Alzheimer's, because when I can't remember anybody's name, I call my children by the wrong names, when I can't remember who I am, then that I must be getting happier. I must be getting better. I only get miserable if someone comes and says, you should know exactly this and that. Don't forget that name, that's terrible. See? Then that gets, we don't need to know someone's name to love them. In fact, sometimes by knowing their name too well, you might get used to disliking them. If you forget that you know, sometimes I do. I meet some people nowadays, and they seem to know me. And they say, oh, you're not mad at me anymore. That's great. I say, I guess not. Don't tell me what you did. It is India that gives us this encouragement. And therefore, India turned in this ancient time in a different direction than the Greeks and then the Romans and then the Europeans and then the Americans. They turned what I call towards, they did the inward turn. They said that the king and the queen of the sciences is the inward science, the science of how to know yourself, how to know your world, how to know the gods, how to know God, depending on what you mean by it. In the Vedanta, they have a wonderful idea they call Nirguna Brahman and Saguna Brahman, showing how the qualified, that means qualified God, God with properties, you know, God with personality, God with attitude, you know. So it was like putting a burning bush someplace or destroying somebody who gets mad. He has kind of God with attitude. But then there's God beyond attitude, you know. And God beyond attitude is no different from us, you know, and therefore nothing to be afraid of. So the first klesha, that's my feeling about the first klesha. The great Bengali, Atisha Dipankara Srinyana, who went to Tibet in the 11th century and was the founder of the new wave of Tibetan Buddhism at that time, he was asked once, because you made me think of it when you mentioned about abstraction and practical living. Mm-hmm. He was asked once, he said, well, Atisha, you're the great master, you taught all the Dharma, blah, blah, blah. He said, but could you tell us a practical thing? One nobleman, Tibetan nobleman, said, and then they said, well, what is that? He said, well, could you give us a little marriage counseling? This is my favorite marriage counseling in the universe. And Atisha said, oh, no, you could talk to someone else. Then he said, no, please, we want some marriage counseling. So then he said, okay, you ready? And he said, we're ready. He said, husband and wife, each of them will soon be dead. Therefore, while living, they should be nice to each other. It's not quite Tagore, but it's to the point, don't you think?
Excellent.
I'm sorry, go ahead. But death is great, you know. When I translated the Book of the Dead, you know, which I didn't want to do because I thought there were enough translations. But then I remembered my guru, you know, my old Mongolian guru, you know, who was the teacher of, where did we cross paths? Oh, Ray Chambers' teacher, too, you know, who I met in the desert flats of New Jersey. You know what it means for a New Yorker to go? I went all the way to India first, and then I met him in the desert flats of New Jersey, my guru, just beyond the refineries there. That's a real shock to New Yorkers, you know. Talk about non-duality. You know? And what was I going to say?
Convinced you to write about death.
Oh, yeah. And he gave me this book. And he said one time, the copy of the Book of the Dead, when I wasn't at all interested in it. And he said, and I said, oh, it's okay. He said, I'll keep it in the library. He said, no, no, you take it. You will need it, he said. And I said, okay. Then later someone asked me to translate it. And that, because he had done that, I said, okay, I'll do it. Because he said I would need it. But what I discovered in translating the book of the so-called Book of the Dead, which isn't called Book of the Dead in Tibetan, I discovered that there are no dead people. There's no dead people. And Tibet is this amazing culture, which is the child of India. in a way, it is kind of, it's up there on the crown of India. You know, it's over the Himalaya. And when India was hard-pressed at the end of the first millennium with foreign invasions, you know, the first really major organized foreign invasions into India, then this knowledge tradition, a lot of it ran up there over the Himalayas, you know, into Tibet. So it really is totally connected to India, whatever anybody says, political people. And it's the one place where a culture, therefore, talks of death as a natural liberation. And how can we fear death when there is only infinite life? And when you do the Book of Natural Liberation, which is what the real name of the Tibetan so-called Book of the Dead is, it's the Book of Natural Liberation through learning in the between state. Because the minute we die, we are totally aware of our virtual reality, like we are a dream body, we are a Maya body. And therefore, what you hear at that time, like, imagine when you die, by the way, you should have Deepak turned on the video player. Because the first thing you're going to know, when you're going to be listening to the same people, but then your body-mind will really be a mind-body, a manomayakaya.
Yeah.
The minute you're dead, this thing will be lying there, this wetware. All the wetware will be lying there like, ugh. And you'll be there, and you'll be wondering, who is that? And you'll be there, and then if Deepak is on the video, he'll be saying, bring those neuropeptides into oneness with Brahma. And you will experience that immediately, because you'll totally, whatever you experience in this totally fluid mind-made body has no resistance from a sort of concrete body filled with fight and flight syndromes and, you know, all of these instinctual, like, you know, like reaction patterns, you know. So you're 9 times more intelligent, they say, in Tibet, the minute you're dead.
Can I give the conceptual map for different states of consciousness?
Please.
And see what the parallels are. Because parallels are.
Please do. Okay. Please do.
So, you know, the way Vedanta describes all of reality is a projection of which state of consciousness you're in. So depending on the state of consciousness you're in, you project a certain kind of reality. The first state of consciousness is deep sleep. And in deep sleep, you also have a certain reality. There's a limited degree of awareness. If I come and scream at you, I say there's a fire on, or your child is crying, and you happen to be the mother, then you immediately respond to that, which means that your spirit is in surveillance even in deep sleep. And the spirit creates its own physiology for that moment. The second, so everyone has experienced that, no need to belabor the point. The second state of consciousness is dreams. Now what we have is a little more repertoire of experience, and our brain is functioning a little differently. There are stories that are being weaved by the karmic software, and when we are dreaming, it's very real. No one can convince us that this is not real. It's only after we wake up that we look back and say, oh, that was an interesting dream. The insight that it was a dream happens after you wake up from the dream, not in the dream. Unless you're a lucid dreamer, which is a whole different thing, which we don't want to talk about right now. But the insight that that was a dream only occurs after you wake up from the dream. Now, Vedanta says, when you wake up from that dream, you wake up into another dream. And that other dream is what you call waking state of consciousness. Presumably, you're at least in that right now. Okay? So, if you're in that waking state of consciousness, then you are in it, you're participating in it, just like you were participating in the dream. And you don't know that it's equally ephemeral, it's equally transitory, it's equally insubstantial, it's equally illusory. And therefore, of course, you get caught up in the melodrama and the hysteria and the anxiety of the dream because you think it's real. And you will remain in it till you wake up from it. And then after you wake up from it, then you'll have the insight, aha, what an interesting state that was.
So, of course, you know, we have different words, bardos mm-hmm. and so on. But here we wake up from the waking state into what Vedanta calls the fourth state of consciousness. The fourth state of consciousness when you have a first glimpse of your soul. People have, when they had that, it's been very dramatic for them. So Walt Whitman says, I must not be awake, for everything looks to me as it never did before, or else I'm awake for the first time, and all that was before was just a dream. Okay, or Gautama Buddha himself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This lifetime of ours is as transient as autumn clouds. To watch the birth and death of beings is like looking at the movements of a dance. A lifetime is like a flash of lightning in the sky, rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountain. But now I'm awake, which is the meaning of the word Buddha. Mm-hmm. You know, he's asked at the moment of his death, are you a prophet? He says, no. Are you the Messiah? He says, no. He says, who are you? He says, I'm awake. That's all he says. That's the meaning of the word Buddha, the awakened one. Waking up from the insubstantial reality into glimpsing the soul. So actually, we could try something right now with you. So you could glimpse it even this moment. As you're listening to me, just turn your attention to who's listening. So as you're listening to me, just turn your attention to who's listening. There's a presence there. It's not your mind. Your mind is still noisy. But just turn your attention to who's listening. And that silent witness, that ever-present witnessing awareness, is the soul. And once we start glimpsing it, then we start to peel the layers of that. And that ever-present witnessing awareness is there even in deep sleep, even in dreams, and even in wakefulness. So the experience that Bob was saying, you're dying and you see the body out there and you can witness it. Well, both Buddha and Vedanta say you can do that now. You don't have to wait till the moment of death. And if you enter that now, you will not fear death. Why? Because the unknown then will be known to you, as Tagore says. And when the unknown is known, what's there to fear? To have that ever-present witnessing awareness in sleeps, in dreams, in waking state, is to suddenly wake up to the full reality of the soul. In Vedantic traditions, it's called cosmic consciousness. It's the fifth state of consciousness, the fourth being just glimpsing the soul. And then beyond that, what Vedanta describes as the sixth state of consciousness, where the ever-present witnessing awareness becomes obvious to you cognitively and perceptually, even in the objects of your perception. So you look at that tree and you say, yes, and you know the Buddhists have this mm-hmm. technique.
Sure, sure, sure.
You look at that tree and you look long enough in that special state of meditative awareness and you see there's a tree there, but there are also rainbows and sunshine and earth and water and wind and space and the infinite void and the whole history of the universe right there in that tree. And you go beyond that, and you see there's a spirit, there's a soul, there's a presence, there's an ever-present witnessing awareness right there. And that's called the sixth state of consciousness. And then a time comes when the ever-present witnessing awareness here in the subject of perception and there in the object of perception is actually the same presence. The whole thing was a perceptual artifact to begin with. So there's only one witness in the whole universe is an expression of that. And that is what Buddha calls enlightenment.
Exactly.
And you know, it's not that difficult to understand. You can actually map out these different states of awareness and soon, hopefully, have the research grants
Absolutely.
To look at how the brain functions in these different states
yeah.
of awareness.
Yeah.
So that people really, for the first time, feel that this is not mere esoteric, Eastern, philosophical, metaphysical speculation that occurred in the consciousness of some enlightened beings, because we all have the same hardware, the same nervous system, and what was possible for Buddha, he himself says, is possible
Absolutely.
For you.
Absolutely.
You, we are the bodhisattvas.
And that generates, that chisho generates, like, a whole, I think it's, I call it Deepanta. Not Vedanta, not Buddhanta, Deepanta.
No.
Deepanta, that is Deepanta. And, you know, that is why I say it's a renaissance. I mean, India is the mother where people were less harassed, who asserted their ability to know their own reality. That's the reason there were more of them, is there were plenty of them in the Mediterranean too, but then some tyrant would arrest them. Even Socrates, you know. What did they give Socrates? We call it a hemlock milkshake around campuses, you know. It's not too healthy, you know. It's not a fruit shake, you know. And so they kind of wiped them out in other places because the authority wanted everybody just not feeling that they know everything. They wanted everybody just working. You know, they wanted them obeying orders. You know? So it happened everywhere. But what we need, what we have to have on the planet now, secularism and the pretensions of materialistic science are not really believed broadly on the planet anymore. You know, what people call fundamentalism, which exists in Hinduism, in Islam, in Christianity, in Buddhism, in every one of the world religions now, Eastern Orthodoxy, it's asserting itself very powerfully again in the world, and that trend will continue, because there is disillusionment in the promises of the great secular materialist age. We're going to save everybody, everybody's going to have a stainless steel pacemaker, do you know what I mean, and a new brain that they're going to make, and some in IBM is going to, Bill Gates is going to come and live in your brain and like make everything work well. And people have really given that up on the planet. You know? But then now, then, if spirituality returns in this old way where people are content and where there's a few mystics who are allowed to know, and everybody else is supposed to just believe and obey, and they're going to have a vengeful God, or they're going to have this kind of jealous God, or they're going to have that kind who's going to go and say, kill the unbelievers, we're going to have absolute chaos. So there should be now a Manhattan Project of the spirit, a Manhattan Project of the mind. If anybody had any brains today, they would be doing that. But my point is, this is a national priority, because people go out there, oh, well, but gee, but you really think people can understand? No, they'll never understand. No, Jerry Falwell is going to always be an idiot. Or else, you know, he's going to be great and the rest of us will be Satan, whatever. It's going to be hopeless polarization is coming. Believe me, the new religious wars are going to make the old ones seem like a tea party. It's going to be really terrible. Only solution is to develop, to take our ingenuity, to take our technologies, to take our information age, and make it where Buddha is on satellite. You know, we have Academy Awards, we have Enlightenment Awards. And, you know, a billion people simultaneously can meditate on recognizing the self in others. No, really. And they can do that. People definitely can do that. I know some Tibetans, you know, who don't know much. They know they can chase their yaks around a field. They don't have a great deal of knowledge. They have bhakti. But, you know, they have been steeping themselves in a culture that understands the connection of knowledge and love, and understands that through their theory of karma, of course, and reincarnation, that we have all been reborn infinitely intertwined, all of us. We've all been lovers. Even the guys, we've all been lovers. We've all been parents and children. We've all been enemies too, but we won't be mentioning that. We've all had all different kinds of problems, but we've been infinitely intertwined. So when this kind of toothless Tibetan today, kind of out there with their yak, knowing very little, looks at you, you feel that they see the kinship in you. And that's all that is needed. So that when your wild, crazy Muslim fundamentalist looks at your wild, crazy Lynchburg, Virginia Protestant fundamentalist, the two are looking at each other, you know, with their each notion of a triumphal, nuclear-tipped God, and yet they look beyond that and they see kin. They see this one guy wearing pajamas and this other guy wearing his little puffy suit, that they're kin. Then they won't kill each other. So these are, you know, the change in consciousness that is planet-saving for our, you know, when you say Maya, I always, of course, think my grandchild's name is Maya. I can't help it. When I think of Maya projecting, I'm thinking of my little Maya grandchild, who is so cute, such a gentle projection. At the moment, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, what are we doing with children and grandchildren and whatever if we're not going to take the fate of this planet seriously? So this is, I'm very into this Shri, you know, second Renaissance, the goddess Shri, you know. Vishnu's, isn't that Vishnu's consort?
Right. But I think in order to make that happen,
yes,
we must not,
yes,
create the schism,
yes,
that currently exists between science and spirituality.
Absolutely.
Because that is the divide right now.
Right.
Either you're a scientist or you are a spiritual being, and the two have nothing to do with each other.
Right.
Mystical poets, etc., have had insights,
right,
without going into the science or the logic,
right,
of it. So there's,
right,
a poem again, Rumi from the 12th century. In one of his poems, he says, "I have lived on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons, knocking at the door. The door opens, I've been knocking from the inside." Now, we all get that immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But now, what the scientists are also saying,
right,
at least in quantum physics,
right,
is that the cosmologist who studies the cosmos,
right,
is an expression of the cosmos.
Right.
The
exactly.
physicist who studies the laws of physics is an expression of those laws of,
right,
physics.
Right.
So there's no such thing as objective science.
Right.
There, it's all subject, object, process of interaction, as you,
right,
said, woven together.
Right.
Inextricably,
right,
woven together.
Right. Right.
Science,
absolutely,
has to change.
Absolutely.
The way science is done has to change.
Right. Well, it is changing slowly,
slowly.
But then there's all this kind of resistance because of their sort of indulged in being sort of the great authority. But, you know, the Buddhists have a saying, Deepak, that the Dalai Lama often says in his dialogues with the scientists, but he never says it too loudly. And I don't think that they've quite heard yet, some, but quite. And that is that there's three levels of relativity from Buddha's teaching, three levels. And the first level of relativity, which is the coarsest one, is where Buddhism and science completely meet, but with a different focus. Buddhists toward the interior as more important, not exclusively important. The exterior is also important, medicine and biology and all that is important, but the interior is more important. But that's cause and effect, you know, causality, and that's the first level, and there's attunement, and there can be a lot of dialogue. Second level is the level of part and whole, and analyzing things in terms of parts and wholes. And that's a more subtle level. And there's also, however, with the sort of, you know, subatomic and the micro dimension, everything, there's also parity there, and there's interconnectedness with science.
Beautiful.
But the third level,
beautiful.
The third level is the level of word and referent, or concept designation and designated, you know, where mind is involved through the word. You know, through Shabda Brahma. You know?
Yeah, because there's nothing that exists for which you don't have a word.
Exactly. And in fact, the word is co-creative with the thing, so that subject and object interconnect with name and form, as they say. And, you know, if you take Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and you say that the subjectivity is, in fact, warping the objectivity in observing it, that destroys the notion of the privileged observer who observes reality, quote-unquote, objectively, not being a participant in reality, which was the Western exaggeration in the attempt to escape from the church.
I hope everybody gets this, because it's very important what he's saying just now.
But so they have that Heisenberg, but then what they, and then they just think the language is mathematics, which is of course a brilliant and wonderful language, but it's even ordinary words. It's mantra is what it is. The ultimate scientific use of languages and poetic, where science and poetry meet, is mantra. You know, Om Mani Padme Hum, you know. And that this mantra is where word is co-creative with form and with life and with vibrancy and with liberation and so forth. And that's where it's all is now and then quietly says in the middle of these dialogues where the great scientists are talking about all their great technology, he's saying, we're waiting to talk there, you know, on that level of relativity where people are responsible for their mind's engagement and creative engagement with reality, what Deepak calls where the creative level of God the Creator, sixth level, I hope. Am I getting it right?
Fifth level.
Fifth. See, I'm not that well schooled yet. Fifth level of God, where the individual takes responsibility of co-creating with God the world, which does not just mean that you're some big deal. It means you better be careful what you think, what you say, because it creates. It's creative. It's divine. Right?
Absolutely. You know, what you said is so important. Can I?
Please.
The concept that Bob has just expressed of co-creation. See, there's constantly this antagonism between the materialists who say that matter causes the subjective experience. So I look out there, and everything out there causes me to have a subjective experience. That's the materialists say that. Other people say, no, you know, it's like, what's his name, Bishop, the, you know, I'm
Barclay Bishop.
Right. He says, no, it's the other way around. The consciousness projects itself as the material universe. And what Buddhism says is you're both wrong. You know, we are inter-beings that arise in the inter-isness, and we are constantly co-creating each other out of that inter-isness. And what physics calls that now is a tangled hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
A tangled hierarchy is something that you can't get out of it because the tangle is infinitely interwoven. So to make it simple, in grammar, a tangled hierarchy would be the following sentence. I am a liar. See, the subject qualifies the predicate, and the predicate qualifies the subject. If I say, I'm a liar, then if I'm lying, I'm telling the truth. And if I'm telling the truth, I must be lying. So what am I? Am I truthful or am I a liar? That's a tangled hierarchy in grammar. And you cannot get out of the tangled hierarchy while you stay in it. The only way to get out of the tangled hierarchy is to jump out of the system, to transcend the system. And in this case, in grammar, you would say, who's making that statement? I'm a liar. And the one who's making that statement is the potential for both lying and telling the truth. So you understand what a tangled hierarchy is? Now in physics, tangled hierarchy says that the subject of experience and the object of experience co-arise simultaneously, moment by moment, from a transcendent domain which is beyond space and time. And that's who you are. You are neither the subject, nor the object, nor the process of interaction between subject and object,
mm-hmm.
but the potential
mm-hmm.
for the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
for the subject, mm-hmm. the object, mm-hmm. and the process of interaction,
mm-hmm.
which is very Vedantic and very, very much Buddhism. You know, you would say, why now and why never before? Because, you know, even though Bob painted a beautiful picture of the ancient Indian civilization, and it is beautiful, but I have to say that we're still talking about an eclectic group of luminaries in ancient India.
Sure.
The majority of Indians were barbarians and still are. Sorry. Okay. Much though, you know.
Sure,
and that's true of the majority of humanity.
Yeah.
When we think of ancient Greece, we think of Parmenides, we think of Socrates, we think of Plato, we think of Pythagoras, and we say, aha, Greek civilization. But look at what the majority of Greeks were doing. They were throwing children, handicapped children, to the lions. They were sexist. They believed in slavery. So we cannot say of
exactly.
any civilization has
exactly.
the prerogative or the privilege for enlightenment, not even India, with
mm-hmm.
all due respect.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm an Indian.
No, absolutely.
You know? And so we've never had a golden age, never. There has never been a renaissance. The history of human beings has been the history of torment and suffering. So why is there room for optimism now? The room for optimism is A, because science is catching on. Science, you know, science is a wonderful thing. It can give us monstrosities,
mm-hmm.
but it can also create amazing benefits for us. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the same science that we can use to destroy the world, we
mm-hmm.
can create a new age of real
mm-hmm.
renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason I say there is hope today is because we have the internet, we have media, you know, and what is a good idea can collectively, immediately saturate a critical threshold in collective consciousness. If an idea is appealing,
mm-hmm.
you cannot
yeah.
stop it.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot stop it. And the idea of a collective enlightenment is now being born.
Mm-hmm.
And it cannot be stopped. It's like
mm-hmm.
a child that comes out of the womb
mm-hmm.
cannot go back to the womb.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is born,
mm-hmm.
and with our technology, it will manifest.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I also think personally, because I locate barbarianhood right here.
Yes.
Bob Redneck, raw redneck Budantic, and barbarism is here also,
of
mixed,
course.
You know, I don't claim to perfection at all, but
I count myself lucky at the blessing of Maya, at seeing Maya in the creative, you know. I think God and Brahma and Indra and Buddha and all the bodhisattvas and all the goddesses and the female Buddhas and so forth, I think they sort of surrounded humanity, you know. Like science, for example, being materialistic, they sort of like trying to grab and cling and misknow and make atoms, you know, and then the atom one day sort of pops up, you know, and there's Buddha, you know, in the atom and Brahma coming out of the atom. And it's like we're kind of surrounded by angels, you know, without realizing it, you know. And they've created this like network of, we call it, it's called in the Indian vision, Indian mythology, the jewel net of Indra is an expression. And the jewel net of Indra is this network of jewels that's from ancient time in India, before there was computers and things and TVs and things. In the Sudarshana, there's a city on the top of the Indian Olympus, of the Indian cosmology, where Indra rules, which is actually only a lower heaven, way below the Brahma heavens, you know. But it is one kind of real estate type heaven, which is like Olympus, very, very, they have a really good time, they have the best jacuzzis, much better than Palm Springs or Bel Air or whatever, and they hang out up there. But the one thing that they have is this jewel net of Indra, and it's this jewel net hangs over the city, and the net is faceted in such a way that when you look in any facet of the jewels, you see all the other facets of the jewels. So it's like a telephone system. It's
holographic.
It's a holographic system that is over that city. And so this jewel net of Indra is like hung around the whole planet, you know, and we see reflected in that, you know, all of each other's interconnections and souls. We've been born and reborn, and we've gone through this agony and that agony, and everybody's back, and nobody has lost, and no baby has been lost, and we're all here, and we're like staring and glaring at each other, and we've done each other in infinite numbers of times, and we're like sick of it.
And remember, the nurturing beings are actually, again, aspects of ourselves, the angels. Yeah? So Rumi says, when I die, I shall soar with angels. And when I die as an angel, what I shall become, you cannot imagine.
That's wonderful. I think Rumi inspired Roosevelt, actually, who of course said, right? Yes. There's nothing to fear but fear. Yeah. With fear, we will destroy ourselves. But with love, realizing that if we even let go of everything, even if you die and you're embraced by love, how can you fear death?
And by the way, the 60s generation has not disappeared. We are sitting here right now, okay? I mean, it never went away. We're sitting right in front of you. We are that generation. So it never really did go away. That was a sudden appearance, and it has continued to grow. The media took away the attention, and now the media is bringing back the attention. But we were never satisfied with the status quo, whether it was the Vietnam or the war movement or the anti-war movement, whether it was ecology, whether it was feminism. We are the ones who started it, a proud generation that is now reaching its maturity. That was our adolescence. That was our puberty. And now we are reaching our maturity, or we think we are.
I'm over the hill.
Yeah? No, you're not, sir. I'll tell you when you get there.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay, Doc.
So it has never gone away. The drug experience for many was a dramatic experience into an altered state of consciousness. And it's true for many spiritual traditions where they use drugs to immediately, whether it's peyote or whether it's mushrooms or whatever, to immediately cause a shift, as Carlos Castaneda would say, in the assemblage point, where you assemble the universe in consciousness. Mm-hmm. But to stay with that experience causes a lot of disintegration. You know, you can have an experience, and if it is dramatic and sudden and radical, there's a thin line between sages and psychotics and geniuses. You know, it's a motley group of sages and psychotics as well. So I would caution that the drug experience is not the way to go for anyone, even though for many, many, including our friends the Beatles and many others,
sure,
it was their first insight.
The catalyst,
mm-hmm. But it's not the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would like just to add about the breaking through is like, take a break. Don't push so hard sometimes. The beautiful thing about Vedanta, about Buddhanta, is that, and the difference between that and some other kinds of ideas of reality, is that the reason Buddha was happy, the reason he smiles, is that what he saw is that it is your actual nature to be happy, to be free, to be released. It is not that you have to create it and break through something to get it elsewhere. It is actually your nature. And sometimes trying too hard to get something that you conceive of as a freedom and misconceptualizing your actual state as a bondage can be over-exaggerated, and one can just kind of relax a little bit. The Dalai Lama always says, I think very rightly, that we mustn't try too hard and set too high an image of what we're trying to get to, because it's actually a trick of how to like defeat our positive outlook. You know, just a tiny little bit, we get a little bit, like drop by drop, we fill the bucket, you know. Step by step, we cross the forest, you know, we cross the desert. We don't try to like run all the whole time and then collapse and then feel that it's impossible, if you follow me. So if you feel too much pressure and too much frustration about trying to break through, take a break.
Take a break.
Take a break. I want to thank you, Deepak.
It's a privilege to be with you.
For coming to visit us at Tibet House.
US Menla Online Podcast is produced through a Creative Commons No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, like, and repost on your favorite social media platforms. To enjoy the full video version of this talk, please visit us on YouTube. We can be found there as Tibet House US Menla Online. And this video is also included as part of our Tibet House US Menla membership community's archives. To enjoy those videos and to become a member, please visit thus.org. Talk to you next.